Leo's scent overlapping both, but seemingly at different moments. Together, the fading scents went up the next set of stairs to Leo's office. Great. Leo had come out of his office lair and met the werewolves, then had come back out and greeted the special agent. Iotis got a private meeting with the MOC, while I dealt with were-creature politics. I dropped my headset off at the foyer security nook and dropped into a chair with a tired sigh. A low voice rumbled slyly, "Want me to rub your feet?" I chuckled up at Rassler. "You big old softy, you. Instead, let me see the security footage. Let's start with Sub 5. I want to know who was responsible for the foobar down there." Rassler frowned. His expression told me that he had already watched the footage and wasn't happy about any part of it. The cameras mounted in the Sub 5 basement showed me most of what I needed to know, beginning with the elevator opening and a female vampire walking out. Pale hair and eyes, her face chiseled and cold, the stark beauty of a glacier in pink silk and ballerina shoes. Dominique, Grey Gua's clan heir. She stepped onto the clay floor of Sub 5, the werecats and wolves behind her, the wolves carrying antifreeze, his head lolling. Inside me, Beast growled low, odd tones in her voice, vibrating through my own chest. Dominique, a 200-year-old powerful vamp, aimed a flat device like a television remote control at the camera. The screen went black. Then the other cameras went black. "What happened?" I asked. "We don't know how she did it," Rassler said. "But she shut off the cameras on Sub 5 with that thing. The entire system covering the lower floor went black. Alex is trying to isolate the security loophole in his integrated system, and we're going over the cam footage of people on stairs and elevators before the outage and after. But so far, we have zip." My fault, I thought. The SOD had ripped out Dominique's throat and I hadn't taken her head. The memory of her dead body at my feet was bright and clear as the vision of her on the screen before me. Leo and Grey Gua had brought her back and restored her, hoping she would lead them to her co-conspirators. Instead, she had pledged fresh loyalty and given them nothing until now. "Where is she now?" I asked. "Gone. I told Grey Gua that his heir attacked HQ, leading our enemies to the Son of Darkness. He's in a rage. He had begun to trust her, foolishly." I let a soft breath go. Crap. Vamps, especially old vamps like Grey Gua, needed their closest allies to be faithful unto true death. Betrayal cut deep. I checked my cell. There was a text from Eli, telling me he and Iotis were with Leo. There was also one from Alex that said, "Spotted an oddity on Sub 5 lasers before cameras went out. Call." It took a moment before I remembered. Alex had done laser upgrades on the security at the entrances and in the gym, the rec room, and Sub 5, places where we'd been attacked in the past. I punched his number and Alex spoke fast. "Anomaly from the lasers in Sub 5, the presence of a witch under an obfuscation spell." "And? Tell me you caught the witch." Rassler whipped his head to me at the words. "No, the witch left with Dominique. But the same anomaly was in the gym earlier, too, unmoving. I tracked the anomaly back and discovered that she, came in the front door with Dominique and some were-creatures and left with her. Any way to alter the system to track this anomaly and see it before it gets in?" Alex hesitated. "I don't know how the magic works. I could talk to Molly." I thought about that possibility for half a second. "I'll call her. I'm heading home in a bit." I hit end and told Rassler what Alex had discovered. He frowned and sat in front of the system, punching buttons to see the anomaly for himself. A familiar face appeared in the doorway. Shemmy, my sometimes driver.
"Yeah, I drive you home, Ms. Yellow Rock."
My security measures had failed,
I was suddenly tired beyond bearing, my legs feeling leaden, and my shoulders drooping. I had lost my scarf in the fight and couldn't make myself go look for it. I did something I seldom ever did. I accepted when a security blood servant offered to drive me home. Yeah, thanks. As we walked through the doors together, a car swept in, and a vampire visitor emerged. She passed us on the front stairs carrying a package addressed to Leo, the name clearly visible. The packaging looked vaguely familiar in terms of vampire business, but I couldn't remember where I saw the kind before or why. I stopped the vamp with an upheld hand and took the package. It was from Leo's biomedical lab in Texas. Not my business. I waved her on and slid into the back seat of the armored SUV and closed my eyes. I didn't move again until I was back home, when Shemmy opened the door for me and wished the enforcer a good rest and happy dreams. And then I looked up and groaned. I wouldn't be given a chance to sleep. The windows upstairs were open, the cold breeze blowing the curtains back and forth in the night. I thought about telling Shemmy to take me to a local bar. I couldn't get drunk, it wasn't in my physiology, but I could nurse a Coke and people watch. Instead, I said, "Thank you. Drive safely back to HQ." I blew out a breath and went inside, where I was met with the sound of electric saws running, nail guns thumping, hammers banging, Latin music playing, and men laughing. The cacophony echoed through the house. In my room, I took off the dancing shoes, pulled off the clothes, the sports bra, and the weapons, leaving them all on the bed, and dressed in a soft tee, a ratty sweatshirt, and leggings. I sat on the bed, crossed my legs guru fashion, and made a call. "Hey, Aunt Jane," Angie said, answering. "How's my sweet girl?" I asked. "I made a big butterfly. Mama punished me. I'm in trouble." But she sounded proud of herself for the entire episode, even the being in trouble part. "How big did you make the butterfly?"
"Big as my feet."
My eyebrows went up. "That's a big butterfly."
"Yep, Mama was mad 'cause she couldn't see where I got the mask from."
My eyebrows went up higher. "You know what mass is?"
"Yep. Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared," she quoted. "Which means that magic and electricity and sunlight, which are energy, are the same stuff as things I can touch, which is mass or matter. And I can interchange them because they're just different forms of the same thing, but I didn't interchange them."
My entire body had gone cold as she spoke. I was pretty sure my heart had stopped beating. "Okay," I managed. "So what did you do to make the butterfly grow big?"
"I didn't make one grow big. I just made a big one come to me. From one of the other places."
I breathed through my mouth in the beginnings of panic. "What other places?"
"There's bunches of other places. One has big butterflies with pink wings and purple eyes and blue bodies and feet. I just pulled it over. Mama's mad at me," she said again, with pride.
"Give me that phone, young lady," Molly said in the background. "Go back to your room and take that dog with you."
In the background, I heard Angie calling her dog and trying to whistle. Into the phone, Molly said,
"She told you?"
About what sounded like she'd pulled a butterfly from an alternate universe into ours?
"Yeah.
She's going to be the death of me," Molly sighed.
"That butterfly was a foot wide and had a stinger the size of my little finger. I had to blast it with death magic to stop it."
"You okay?" My BFF, Molly Megan Everhart Trueblood, had a problem with the evolution of her magic and had lost herself to death magic once or twice. That was way scarier than pulling butterflies from alternate universes.
"I'm good. I play a lot of Evan's music these days and keep that dang cat close."
The dang cat was Molly's familiar, though witches didn't have familiars, ever. It was too cliche for real life.
"What's up?"
"Two things. First, We had a witch under an obfuscation spell enter through the sensors. The lasers picked up the anomaly, but we only spotted it after the fact. It was too small a change to see it in real time. I'm wondering if there's a way to rig a ward or a magical something to alert us when someone comes in the door. Molly was quiet, and I could almost see her purse in her lips and squint in her eyes as she thought. The entrances have the metal detectors and the x-ray scanners like at airports, right?
Yes.
And all the security setup is close by, with cameras? My heart thudded down. Right. Magic and electronics. Too much either in the same place and something was likely to go bang. Molly's next words confirmed that thought. Anything I might send would fritz out in short order. Someone could set up a hedge outside, but it needs to be hands-on with that many people coming and going. I could call Lakish Dudie to set one up, but she'd have to stay there. Her voice sounded amused. Lakish was the head of the Nola Coven, and she didn't like me much. Lakish didn't like vamps much either, so no way would she provide security for us against another witch.
Yeah, no thanks, I said.
Second, I'm pretty sure we're looking at the formation of Clan Yellow Rock in the Fanghead Manor in the next few days. You still up for that? Being part of a vamp clan will give you and Big Evan power and protection from other vamps. It'll help to keep you all safe. Keep the kids safe. Keep Eli and Alex and all my people safe. But I didn't need to add that part. Janie, I'd suck vamp blood myself if it kept my children safe from the Europeans. Remember, I'm ready to come if and when you need me. This can be handled over an electronic connection. You stay where you are and take care of my next godchild, understand? I do. I love you, Big Cat. I love you too, Maul. We ended the call. I stared at the cell face for a while, remembering why I was doing everything in my life. To protect my godchildren. To keep them safe from bloodsuckers who killed or turned every witch they could find and who would take Angie Baby and little Evan and Molly's unborn daughter. And I stopped the visions that wanted to swarm through me. I didn't have time for them or for the fear that rode me every time I thought about the danger the children were in. Brick by mental brick, I blocked away the images and the panic. Pulling out a notepad, I wrote a note to Alex to check on the injured guards and tequila antifreeze. I left it on his desk in the living room. Barefooted, I traipsed up the stairs to the second floor and stopped at the landing. The hardwood-floored landing ran the length of the house from front to back, a wide hallway separating the four bedrooms into two on the left and two on the right, with old-fashioned bathrooms on each side. From the bathroom Eli used, I caught the faintest hint of lemon before it vanished on the air currents rushing through the house. Paper had been taped over the hardwood, and there was a load of lumber on top of it. A table saw sat in the middle of the room. Three ladders of various styles were propped here and there. A skill saw lay on its side, and hammers, measuring tapes, pencils, cola cans, and fast food wrappers were everywhere. A boombox played from somewhere out of sight. Three men stood on the second floor with me and two on rafters above, where a hole had been cut in the ceiling, to the attic, what would soon be the third floor, though in Nola speak it would be the atelier. But the hole was a lot bigger than I expected, covering the entire area from wall to wall. Way more demo than I had anticipated. I thought about weeping at the lack of sleep, but I could survive being sleepy. I took in the smells, fresh pine wood with an underlay of garlic, beer, a little weed, hot peppers, and chili from the men I didn't know. Even less obvious was the scent of vamp from the one man I did know. Two beams sawn with right-angled cutouts for risers and treads were lying on the floor, and the far wall was covered with penciled lines and scuff marks to create a narrow stairwell next to the stairs from the first floor. I waved at the hole overhead. "Can I see up there?" Edmund looked at me and at the hole and knelt near me, his fingers laced together and his hands cupped for my foot. I expected to climb a ladder, I said, my tone wry. It is an old house. The ceilings are 12 feet high, and the ladders are not quite tall enough, Ed said. We had to stand them on the stack of drywall and plywood to cut the hole overhead, and those stacks are now upstairs. Longer ladders are on the way. Until then, the men are pulling each other up. Please allow me to boost you.
I was tired. Vamps were strong. Beast was really good at catching us. I shrugged and stepped back, took a running start and raced to Edmund. My primo accepted and collected my weight without a bobble, tossing me high. I caught the rafters overhead and let momentum and beast pull me into the attic. I heard the muttered comments of the crew as I landed, probably looking as if I'd flown up there.
Bruja?
The men backed away, slowly, not turning their backs.
Bebedor de sangre?
All the men crossed themselves. Several said,
Madre de Dios,
in tones of fear.
Vampira,
pointing to me, not Ed, who was coming up behind me, which was funny.
No, I said.
See,
more crossing.
No, I said back. No vampira, no bruja, just strong.
I made a muscle.
Black widow from Marvel?
A guy with a droopy paunch asked. It came out Black Widow. The other guy said,
Natasha Romanova,
and shaped an hourglass figure in the air with his hands. Sort of, kinda. Being a superhero was way better than scaring the humans with the truth. They elbowed each other in approval, saying, Si,
la araña viuda,
si, si, si. The space up here was amazing. There were dormers along one side of the roof system, and the windows had been removed, leaving openings to the night. A new window rested below each opening, ready for insertion. 2x4s were up to indicate where the soundproofed walls would go, 3 smaller rooms on the back side of the house, with a minuscule bathroom and a large workout area on the front part. After the walls were finished, the hardwood flooring was in, and the place was painted. The free weights and workout equipment would go up here, along with a rubberized fighting mat. I nodded, said all the appropriate things, and told them I had to get a nap. They laughed at me. I levered myself, dropped down to the floor below, dodging a man carrying an extendable ladder. I made another muscle, posing for him, trotted down to the first floor and found my bed. Even with all the noise, I slept for hours. I checked the weather when I woke, and the high today was supposed to be a chilly 52 degrees. I pulled on undies, leggings to protect my legs from the weapons harness, and a nice long-sleeved silk tee. Over that went the harness, the weapons, a skirt with slits for said weapons, a thin-knit turtleneck tunic sweater that matched my eyes, and stakes in the top of my French braid. It was daylight, and I was overdressed for daytime in NOLA. But Bruiser was picking me up. It was lunch and business. The gumbo shop on St. Peter Street. I left a note for my partners, both of whom were still sleeping, before I tiptoed out. The sun was shining, the breeze was out of the south, and the weather was practically balmy. I texted Bruiser that I would walk in his direction to meet him, and he could pick me up. I initiated my GPS so he could follow my progress, and started down the street. The sound of traffic was all around, a steady, never-ending roar. People talking, music playing, some live from street musicians, some from cars as they passed, some from clubs. The smell of spicy food made with thick roux and onions and peppers, meat smoking on a grill, seafood fried in lard, coffee, exhaust. The mixed scents of water from the Mississippi, the bayous that ran through the city, and Lake Pontchartrain. Urine. Vomit. The city had hosted one of its ubiquitous celebrations the week before, and we hadn't had a gully washer since a magic storm held the city captive. Few humans could smell it, but I could. I passed 2 homeless men sleeping in a doorway. Another slept on the ground in an alley.
A car with a mismatched paint job and spinning wheels rolled past, and two kids wearing navy blue hooded jackets leaned out the windows, sitting on the window edges, catcalling, telling me that they had some big, things for me. I laughed and ignored them. If they tried anything, I had some things for them, too. And they were shiny and sharp with the word no written on them in blood. They pulled away when they realized they weren't getting a rise out of me. I strolled past two- and three-story buildings, almost all with galleries and wrought iron balconies, restaurants and storefronts and candy shops, selling kitsch or food or drinks or a combo of all three. A surprising number were closed, work and shutters latched, doors padlocked and sometimes sealed with chains. Rents were high in the quarter, and times were hard in the city. There had been an influx of money in the years since the last major hurricane, but the city was still trying to recover. I hadn't really liked New Orleans when I moved here. It was supposed to be a short-term job, then back to the mountains and my apartment in Asheville. And then I met Rick, and Leo offered me a more permanent job, and I found an excuse to stay for a while. I'd been stupid. Rick had player written all over him, and I hadn't bothered to notice. I had needed to solve the mystery involving the missing witch children, then kill off the vamps who had been taken and sacrificing them for the power in their blood. The continuing danger to the witches had been another reason to stick around. I needed to find a way to keep the local vamps in power when big, bad fangbangers wanted to take over the city and its cattle, meaning humans and witches. Now there were the Youngers, my family by choice. And there was Bruiser. That man was a reason to stay here. I'd stayed. I'd cleaned up a lot of messes. If the Sangre Duello was the last mess I needed to clean up, I would have no reason to stick around. Except the Youngers and Bruiser. The Youngers were family. They had made it clear that they were in this for the long haul. Would my honey bunch want me to stay? We hadn't talked about it, hadn't talked about what ifs. Maybe things were too tenuous to plan ahead, to dream ahead. That left me feeling odd, empty, maybe a little bit lost. My beast sent me images. One superimposed on the other, memories of snow piled 2 feet deep, pristine except for the prints of deer, of tall waterfalls sliding between iced rocks, of her lithe body leaping from an ice-crusted tree, thick tail rotating for balance and direction, landing on a buck racing down a steep ravine, sinking teeth in at his spine, of dropping on one at a summertime watering hole, sinking teeth into its muscled throat, holding it until the prey passed out from lack of air, of the spurt of hot blood and the taste of raw venison. There's something to be said for warm weather. Lots of rain and dining on gator, I reminded her. But yeah, I miss the mountains too. Hunt cow. Hunt cow in Edmund's car, she sent back. It wasn't gonna happen. Edmund's car was worth over $3 million. Beast didn't understand money, or numbers greater than 5, and, like a cat, figured she could either wear me down or outsmart me into getting what she wanted. I was halfway to the gumbo shop when I felt it, my predator responses zinging, the presence of someone watching. I was used to casual observers. The MOC's enforcer got a lot of that from locals and tourists, too. This was the interest of a hunter, my body in his sights, or hers. A sniper had targeted me not so long ago, and that experience had left some part of me hyper-alert, always vigilant, in the back of my, our, mind. Beast knew when we were being hunted. Not speeding my steps, I jaywalked across the street and stopped in front of a window as if attracted by the silver jewelry on display. But mostly just watching my trail and the parked cars and the buildings across the way for anything or anyone suspicious. I saw nothing, except the car with the teens in it, cruising back around the block. This time the windows were up, the hecklers inside, and the car was moving slowly, at a walking pace. My walking pace. Which begged the question, were they tailing me for purposes of their own? Or were they tailing me because someone paid them to watch for me and tail me? Beast sent me an image of her leap into the hood of the car and swatting at them. I sent her one of them shooting her through the windshield. She snarled, frustrated. I wasn't sure when Beast had developed this love of battle, but she was a lot more aggressive than before. I tapped out a quick text to Bruiser. Where are you? He sent one back. 10 minutes out. Held up. Get a table. Be there soon. Too far away. Across the street, in a second-story window, I saw movement. The window was up about 6 inches. Something small and round emerged into the sunlight. Gun barrel? I walked into the shop and quickly beyond the entrance. I pulled a 20 from the tiny pocket in my waistband. To the red-headed woman in the back of the shop behind the counter, I said, "A car is following me. Can I get out the back?" "Cop car?" she asked, reaching under the counter. "Or gangbangers?" "I'm going with gangbangers. Clothes are alike." She brought out a sawed-off shotgun and laid it on the counter. I froze until I saw it was pointing away from me. Sawed-offs had a hella kick. But the redhead was a big woman and looked as if she knew her way around the weapon. She had full-sleeve tats with skulls on both arms, a dragon on the left, and black roses on the right. The tats extended up her neck where blackbirds flew into her scarlet hairline. She asked, "Dark gray four-door sedan with a blue driver's door?" I thought back, surprised. "Yeah." She lifted a horizontal slab of counter and said, "Put your money away and get back here. That car has been up and down the streets around here for days. I've called NOPD every day and they did a stop and frisk, but they got zilch. There's nothing they can do until the guys commit a crime. Get out of here. Back door leads to a long, narrow courtyard and an apartment. My landlady lives there. Knock and tell her Andromeda sent you. She'll let you out to a covered passageway. Follow her directions out to St. Peter Street." The gumbo shop was on St. Peter. There would be collateral damage if I was followed. I looked over my shoulder to see the mismatched car pull to a stop in the street. This wasn't accidental or coincidental. They were here for me. Beast moved to peer out of my eyes. "Fight? Can eat one?" Seeing the car stop, Andromeda cursed and leaned down to press a red button on the side of the cabinet. Even her fingers were tattooed with musical notes and barbed wire. "Silent alarm," she said. "The security company will contact the cops, and we already have video running." "I'm not leaving you here alone," I said to Andromeda. I sent a fast text to Bruiser, pulled the H&K 9mm, and joined her behind the counter. The display cases were old-fashioned, and though the fronts and tops were glass, the sides and back were constructed of heavy old wood. I pulled my vamp killers and placed them on the counter. "You ever fired that sawed-off?" She looked at me, taking in the golden glow of Beast in my eyes. "You're Jane Yellowrock." 3 young men moved toward the shop, their gaits streetwise and threatening. 2 of them hid their faces in their navy hoodies and reached into their jeans in a weapon draw. They were older than I'd first thought. 20-somethings. Not kids. "I am." "Fight," Beast said. "This is my daddy's gun. It's got a kick, but yeah, I can handle it." She withdrew a small 9mm from below the counter, too, and racked the slide. "Bloods? Crips?" I asked, as the guys moved through the traffic. Behind them, horns blared, but the mismatched car didn't move. "No one's seen Crip or Blood for weeks. Word is that the fanghead M.O.C. took them out." She shot me a glance. She meant my boss. "These are homegrown gangs, filling back in where the national boys used to be. Call themselves the Zips. They paint big navy blue Z graffiti everywhere. They're looking to make a name for themselves. My brother runs with the Razors, another local gang. This is Ray's territory." Out front, the young men gathered in a tight grouping, one talking, by his body language, giving orders. He was wearing khakis, no hoodie. "This could get messy," I said. "No shit, Pollyanna."
"Am beast, not Pollyanna,"
I chuffed in amusement, showing teeth. The woman picked up the sawed-off and held it in a one-hand grip, the other hand holding the 9mm, her feet spread. She knew how to make an impression. The modified barrel looked like a cannon. The guy in front opened the door. Came in out of the glare, blinking, arm up, gun held in a street-style shooting angle, sideways. With that stance, if he hit us, it would be by accident. Andromeda said, "Stop or die," when they kept coming. She fired the 9mm. Chapter 5. I can't shoot a suspect on the ground. The round hit the wall at the floor, a deliberate shot. "Next one draws blood," she said over the ear-blasted dead air left behind.
"Give us the woman,"
Khaki Man shouted. His eyes were wide. He hadn't expected armed resistance, or getting shot at. "No," Andromeda said. The men spread out in a small semicircle, blocking the front exit, two hoodies on the left, Khaki Man on the right. Andromeda shifted the 9mm to the man on the far left. "I got the navy jackets. You take out the other one," she said. I let Beast flood into me. My heart rate sped. My breathing deepened. I took a breath, smelling testosterone, aggression, and chemicals in their blood. And I caught an unexpected scent of wolf. The guy in the center fired. Time slowed, that battlefield awareness that showed me the angle of the shot. The blast stole the last of the silence. He missed us both. Andromeda fired the shotgun. It deafened, stole the air, replaced it with a roiling cloud of gunfire residue. The guy in the middle stumbled and fell. The other hoodie fired. I firmed my aim, fired twice. Andromeda dropped the shotgun and fired the 9mm. All three men were on the floor, one with a large circular shot pattern on his chest. Messy.
"Fun,"
Beast said.
"More."
I raced around the counter and disarmed the three guys, even the dead ones, by gently shoving the weapons to the side with my foot. Carefully. People had died by kicking guns and getting shot. Out front, the gang car took off.
"What the hell?"
Andromeda shouted, barely heard over the deafness of the gunfight, furious. I tracked the unexpected scent I had caught just before the firing started, to the khaki-clad guy. Over the damage to my ears, I heard sirens and Andromeda cursing as she spotted the bullet hole damage to the walls and the jewelry cases. Scowling, she took in the damage to one cabinet. The wood that had once been beautifully carved, swans with long necks intertwined, and the antique glass, which was now all over the floor. She cursed long and hard at the damage. I took her weapon from her and set it with mine on the counter. Texted a fast 911 to Bruiser. Then, shots fired. "Am okay. Cops on way. Call lawyer." I added the address. I got back. Varin 22. 20 seconds later, Bruiser sprinted to the front of the shop and stopped. He was breathing hard, eyes wide and determined. He had been 10 minutes away when this all started. He got here a lot faster on foot, running. He opened the door needing to see me, his scent washing into the room, over the smell of weapons fire, full of fear. I smiled at him and said, "I'm not hit." He let a harsh breath go, gave me a nod, and let the door close. George Dumas, elegant and urbane, no longer out of breath or terrified, was standing there with his cell phone to his ear talking when the cops pulled up. There was something disarming about the appearance of the local celebrity, casually talking on the phone, and I could see the cops instantly decompress, though they came at him with weapons drawn. Bruiser held his arms in the air, and though my ears weren't healed, I could make out the soothing timbre of his voice. It was pacifying, calming, in control of himself and everything around him. The cops nodded, entered. Andromeda and I were standing with our hands up. The cops took in the three guys, looked at us, and looked back at the three guys. The one on the right was still breathing. "Jane Yellowrock," the older cop said. "Yep." I pointed with one finger to the breathing guy. "Be careful. That one is werewolf. They can bite when they're in pain." The cops shuffled back through the opening, though to give them credit, they did keep the door open. "Werewolf?" Andromeda squeaked. And then she laughed, sounding half hysterical, saying, "They're wolf." When I didn't respond, she added, "Movie quote." I grunted. The guy on the floor was making strange puppy sounds, and hair was starting to sprout on his hands and face. Reddish hair. And he was the only one of the attackers not wearing a Navy gang jacket. Interestinger and interestinger.
"What are we supposed to do?"
the cop holding the door asked. "Get us out, seal the place up, and, well, crap," I huffed in annoyance. "And call Psy-Led. They have agents in town. I can give you the numbers of two of them." The cops didn't ask for the numbers. They were still freaked at the idea of a where. Bruiser re-entered. His nostrils widened at the stench of werewolf blood. Onorios have better than human sense of smell, but he hadn't caught it the first time. His eyes searched me for signs of bite marks or torn flesh. I gave him a thumb up to let him know I hadn't been bitten. To the cops, he said, "Medic is caught in traffic. If you can clear the street, they can get in to help that one." "We need a werewolf cage," I said again. Bruiser frowned and punched in a number. "Psy-Led has portable cages." "If you have silver ammo," I said to the cop, "now's the time for it. If he gets shifted and is still in pain," I glanced at Andromeda and half-joked, "things'll get messy." Andromeda laughed, the sound only slightly panicked now that the shooting was over. "Call me Andy." "Jane."
"I can't shoot a suspect on the ground,"
the cop said.
"You can if he's a menace to the public."
The cop looked at the wolf, at his partner, at me.
"You shoot him."
"Not my job once the cops are here. I'd stake him if he was a vamp and a menace to the public, but not a furball. He's all yours." The guy on the ground started growling. He must have had strong feelings about the direction of the conversation. More hair sprouted. The cop cursed under his breath and changed out mags while calling his supervisor. After that, it was disorganized organization, with the cops putting a round in the ware's knee to keep him in a partial shift and out of action. The wolf man was seriously ticked off about being shot again. The local LEOs took our weapons, all of them, even the stakes. And my adrenaline dissipated enough for me to realize two humans had attacked me, and now they were dead. 20-somethings, not children. Violent and ready to kidnap or kill me, or some violent combo of the two. But still, humans. There was a time when killing humans would have broken my heart, sent me into depression. But there are just so many times one's heart can be broken before it hardens in some sad, fragmented, disarranged formation, where it doesn't work right anymore. I felt almost nothing, and I was more sad about that than I was about killing the gangbangers. Unconcerned, Beast thought, "Jane is war woman. We are Beast. Killed enemy." All the last of the battle energy drained out of me. I sat on a stool, perched in the corner, sick to my stomach. Rick walked in the door, his cat scent sending the doggy on the floor into spasms of fury. He flashed his badge and ID, then glared and pointed a finger at me.
We need to talk about my new house cat.
I nodded once. To the cops, he continued. This is a side-led investigation. I'll take over as OIC until my supervisor arrives. OIC was officer in charge. I started to relax when the cop who had reshot the furball said,
Sorry, gang task force is here. They have jurisdiction.
Rick frowned. The cop grinned. He clearly found it amusing that the meddlesome bureaucrat cop in street clothes was not going to get his way. And then Iotis walked in with a portly man in a suit, and the cop's amusement faded away.
Lafleur, Iotis said. This is Gomez, GTF. He's been tracking the local gangs for 2 years.
Rick and Gomez shook hands. Iotis glanced at me and Andromeda, but didn't acknowledge us. His hair was braided back and hung down the center of his spine.
GTFs had reports of strangers running with the Zips.
Werewolf strangers? Rick asked.
Gomez dropped to one knee and studied the downed wear, comparing him to photos of men on his phone, one thumb flicking from pick to pick. He stopped on one and held the cell up to Andy and me.
He's a little too furry right now to be sure, but this him?
No, we said.
This?
Gomez brought up another pick.
No.
I realized we were getting a quickie photo lineup, like in the basement of a cop shop.
This?
Gomez asked.
Yes,
Andy and I said. Gomez marked his screen, grunted, and stood. To Andy, Gomez said,
He's been seen with the Zips and with a guy who goes by the name Marco Agrios. White, just under 6 feet, brown and brown, sharp dresser. You or your brother know anything about Marco?
Andy looked as if she would rather not answer, but she finally said, I can ask around some. Give me your card. Gomez held out a business card, and Andy tucked it behind the register. Gomez nodded, looked me over, and spoke to Iotis.
You got a safe place to store him until he heals? We don't want his kind in with the lockup pup, making fur babies out of the locals.
Yes,
Rick said, when Iotis glanced at him.
We'll take care of it.
Gomez gave another grunt and left the jewelry shop. Iotis studied me. I watched him back, wary.
Why would he target you?
He asked.
No idea.
If you need protection, I can arrange it.
I raised my eyebrows at him. Really? For little old me? You want I should curtsy and clasp my hands to my chest, maybe flutter my eyes and sigh some?
What about me?
Beside me, Andy dropped into a clumsy curtsy and fluttered her eyes at him.
I'll do a lot more than that to get you for my protection.
Iotis laughed kindly, flashing pearly whites, clearly accustomed to people trying to pick him up.
A war woman can die too. Be careful out there.
Yeah, I said.
War woman?
She pointed at her right arm above her wrist.
I might have that tattooed right here.
I just smiled. Rick pointed a finger at me and said,
We are not done with cat business.
Moments later, Andy and I were hauled off to the 8th precinct and separated. My last words to her were,
I owe you a lawyer.
Her last words to me were,
Make him pretty.
We spent time in holding cells until lawyers could arrive and we could be interviewed. Leo had several lawyers on retainer, but Brandon Robert was my lawyer of choice, a graduate of Tulane Law LLM back in 1946. I hadn't seen him in a couple weeks. The Honorio looked good, though his suit hung on his leaner frame. He moved less fluidly, and his eyes were still a little hollow. It took time to get over being tied to a beam, tortured and drained of blood. Sometimes life just sucked.
Jane,
he said.
I've requested an interview room. Are you hurt?
No, I just hate cages.
Yes, I know what you mean.
He followed, silent, as the cops moved me to an interrogation room, stood as they locked the door on us, and leaned with his back against the wall. He asked, "Is it true they targeted you specifically, not the store owner?" "Yes, there's security video, and one wasn't a gangbanger. He's werewolf." "So I hear. Is it true you wish me to offer legal services to Andromeda Prio?"
"Yeah, she tried to get me out the back door before the shooting started. Would you check on her?"
"In a moment."
"You do seem to attract heroes.
How do you know they were targeting you?"
"Andy said the car had been patrolling the streets in the area for days. They hit on me and rolled past."
"Hit on you?"
"Offered me their services." When he looked confused, I said, "Offered to take me to bed and not to snooze." Brandon shook his head.
"Horrors. Go on."
"Yeah. Then they came back. They followed me into the shop. They said, 'Get the woman,' or something like that. It wasn't hard to tell I was their target."
"They left and they came back,"
he clarified.
"And they had been patrolling the area around St. Peter Street."
Something was wrong here. More carefully, I said, "I hadn't seen them before, but that's what Andromeda said."
"When they came back, was their demeanor the same or different?"
"I'm not following you," I said. He spoke slowly, as he might to a small child or someone he didn't want to upset.
"I had Alex do a search of traffic cams. His car has been patrolling the area between St. Philip Street and your home. That area also encloses St. Peter Street and the streets between. However, no one knew you would be walking toward St. Peter Street."
"Okay." And then it hit me. Bruiser lived on St. Philip Street. Maybe they hadn't been searching for me. Maybe they had been after Bruiser. They had said something like, "Give me the woman." Had I been nothing but a lever to get to Bruiser? They weren't after me exactly.
"It's possible that you were the means to an end, not the end itself."
I sat down on the hard chair, going back over everything that had happened. They wanted Bruiser, not me. Bruiser. Rage flared up in me like a torch. Why Bruiser? And then it occurred to me that Bruiser had been Leo's flunky for decades. Together they had hunted and killed werewolves. I'd once seen a photo of them standing over a dead werewolf. There had been werewolves in Sub 5 when the cats tried to steal the SOD. Those wolves had wanted to steal Brute, who had been biting the SOD and who had time-walking abilities. I hadn't been able to explore that aspect of this puzzle thanks to Brute's inability to shift a human and talk to me. Bruiser might have been involved in questioning the werewolves who hurt Rick. This could have been a snatch-and-grab attempt, or it might be a more complicated situation than a simple kidnapping.
"Right," Brandon said, seeing my reaction. "I'll let you think for a bit and see if Andromeda wants my services."
He left and came back moments later.
"Are you absolutely certain that you want me to represent her?"
"Yeah, why do you ask?" "Again.
She told me I was pretty, and that she likes to sleep with lawyers. She suggested a list of positions and toys and games we could play."
I tried to hold in a grin. It must not have been successful because Brandon frowned.
"I like sex as much as the next guy, but some of the things she said were downright scary."
His eyes narrowed at me when I laughed.
"And her tattoos are razor tats."
"Her brother runs with the rays. Didn't know about her. Don't care. This is vamp business. Leo pays her legal fees." Brandon gave me an abbreviated shrug and sat, placing a briefcase on the table between us. He pulled out a pad and pencil. The Roberts were old school.
"Tell me what happened again. Leave nothing out, no matter how seemingly insignificant."
Which was when I remembered the open window and the barrel pointing down at me. I talked through the sequence of events, and when I reached the part about the possibility of a shooter,
Brandon left the room again and said something to the guard. Moments later, a detective appeared and Brandon invited him into the room. He was dour, tired, and supposed to be off shift 2 hours before. I think he blamed me for keeping him on the clock, but really he should be blaming the dead guys and the furry guy. Tell Detective Curligan what you told me. Be specific about directions, locations, everything. I did as I was told. Curligan took notes, had me draw out the building across the street, and pinpoint the window where I had seen activity. I was specific and detailed, if not artistic. I couldn't draw a stick figure, but I could count windows. I circled the window where the gun barrel, if it was a gun barrel, had tracked me. Curligan left, and I told Brandon everything else. What happened to the wolf? I asked. The Fleur called some people and hauled him off. And? Cy Ledin wares are not my concern, he said. They should be. There were 3 werewolves in Sub-5 basement less than 24 hours ago, and they seemed to be having an argument. What kind of argument? Bighorn Wolf Pack or the new Montana Red Pack? I got no idea, I said. One wolf drew a gun on 2 others, but I can't tell one pack from the other. They came in with Dominique and a witch under an obfuscation spell, a good one. The lasers detected it, but not in time to catch the witch. Leo parleyed in agreement with the Bighorns, but Montana recently split off from them. It's possible that Montana came here with the intent of helping the Europeans. I overheard the wolves say they were there to rescue Brute, who wasn't pleased at the statement, by the way. Brandon frowned, his brow crinkling, confused. They were on Sub-5, I said, with the Werecat delegation from PAW and the IAW, who were there because of the SOD. You didn't know? About an attack by the Werecats? He cursed succinctly. No, I've been working on legal briefs for 2 days. Debrief me. I did and ended with, Assad may have wanted to start a cat-wolf war, or a vamp-ware war, or the kitties and pups might have joined forces temporarily to steal the SOD and Brute, or something open-ended and more twisted. I don't know, and I have no idea how we can find out. Brandon used his cell phone to call Vamp HQ and knocked on the door as if alerting someone on the outside, like a prearranged signal. Detective Curligan re-entered about the time that Brandon finished his conversation with HQ, and we 3 sat at the table. Upon advice from counsel, I answered all the detective's questions at length, 3 times. After the 3rd time through the events, I said, I'm done. I stood up and looked down at my lawyer. Get me out of here. Charge my client with a crime or let her go. Curligan sounded tired and jaded when he said, She's both a person of interest and a possible suspect in the deaths of 2 humans and the injury of a werewolf. You have video of the shooting? Brandon said. You have police corroboration of the threat of the gang members. She has been totally cooperative. Jane Yellowrock is not a flight risk, and she hasn't eaten in hours. You have a mountain of evidence saying that the deaths were self-defense, and she told the senior officer on scene that there was a werewolf on site, one who was shifting and could have posed a danger to the officers and to the public. She was helpful in keeping local law enforcement safe. The detective placed his open hands on the table. We can keep her for 72 hours. I shot him a look that said, No, you can't. All that will get you is her clamming up and refusing to help NOPD ever again. Brandon leaned in, over the table. That would create a danger to the city, and you know that. She's helped officers in the past. She saved the life of the chief of police. She helped those officers today. Don't screw up a system that works. Curligan stood and knocked on the door, which opened immediately. Make sure she doesn't leave town, he said as he left the room. I have to go see Andromeda, Brandon said.
God help me.
I just smiled and let him lead me out of the interrogation room. I accepted my weapons and put them into the tote bag that Kerligan magically produced for me. Checked my cell to discover Alex had sent a dozen texts while I didn't have access to my phone. The only one that mattered was the one that said T. Antifreeze and the guards who had been injured when the wearers went to sub-5 were okay. Healed by vamp blood and downtime. That put me in a better mood. I left the 8th, exited into the chill and the early dusk, and told Shemmy to take me back to Andromeda Prio's jewelry shop. Traffic was horrid, and after I texted Bruiser to meet me there, I took a speed nap in the back seat. Bruiser and I went into the building across the street from Andromeda's and up to the unoccupied second floor to inspect the hide used by the possible shooter. The building had been cleared by the cops, and as we searched, I told him my concerns about the gangbangers and the wolf with the gun and the were-creatures in sub-5, also one with a gun, and how the wolves seemed to be at odds. We talked over other possibilities. Some far-fetched, some downright scary. Together we concluded that there was nothing we could do and no way to discern the truth for now. Bruiser ended the discussion by calling Leo. I wandered around alone for a while. There was no electricity in the untenanted building. The room where the round thing had appeared in the open window was empty, except for a metal folding chair. The chair and the window sash had been dusted for fingerprints, the powder easy to spot in the olive-green room, dusty in Beast's sharp vision. The place had been filled with too many cops and crime scene techs for me to get a specific scent, but I caught a whiff of lemon on the chair when I bent over it. The scent seemed familiar, but the memory wouldn't come. Other than that, there was nothing. From the doorway, Bruiser said, NOPD thinks the person who was in this room had been here for days. A squatter, most likely. Kerligan said that CSI hauled off several dozen sealed pee bottles and one sealed 5-gallon container of feces. He sounded aggrieved at having to say the words, and I let my mouth curl up at the tone. This entire building is empty, and there are signs the person, or persons, have been in every room. I wondered how many other buildings had squatters in them, and how many of the squatters were actually shooters. How widespread was the search for Bruiser, or me, and why? We wandered the second floor, and I caught the fading scent in several places. I know it's stupid, but I smell lemons. Real lemons, not synthetic like in dish soap. Bruiser stopped, thinking, head tilted. His skin and eyes silvered in Beast's vision. Mate, Beast thought happily. He said, there is a Mithrin clan that scents of lemons, but there are no indications that Clan des Citrons has left France to join with Titus in the Sangre Duello. If this shooter is one of their humans, then that opens up a number of possibilities. None of them good. Vamps are ready to jump into the fray at any point where they can benefit, I said. Or at the end of the blood duel when they could declare war against the winner and take over. And then I remembered. I smelled this scent before. Bruiser's eyes moved to me, waiting. This person has either been in my house or was standing on thin air outside Eli's bathroom. The window had been open. The entire house had been breezy. Or maybe they followed me home and were standing on the brick wall outside the house listening. Watching. Also, I caught a faint whiff of lemons in HQ. On sub-5. Bruiser shook his head. Someone is watching all of us. And that someone had access to HQ. I'll put Alex on it, I said. We'll find them. Derek can dedicate a few security personnel to your neighborhood. He shrugged, looking relaxed, but I had a feeling he was a lot more concerned than he pretended. Casually, he added, dinner then, and we'll keep an eye out for trolling gangbangers and errant shooters.
The Creole platter at the gumbo shop consisted of a large platter of shrimp creole, jambalaya, and crawfish etouffee. I had two platters, inhaling the first one so fast I only noted it as a blistered sensation on the back of my throat. Bruiser had the red beans and rice with a lovely smoked sausage and the chicken espagnole.